Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. We have an empowerment hour for you. We're going to talk about how much sodium is enough to meet your needs, and then what happens when you get too much sodium. A little clue, you can get more sodium than what your body needs in just one dish in one meal. So I'll go over that with you. Also, what type of chocolate is best for your health and your heart? Harvard University has a study on that. And Harvard also has a study on sodium. Then we're going to look at it's not just what you eat, but it's how much that determines how long you live. Florida State University has one on that, Florida Atlantic University. And then when you are low in the omega-3 fatty acids, which most people are, according to the China Medical University in Taiwan, that leads to depression and a whole lot more on health and healing, all quality, cutting edge. And I selected studies based upon what you have not been reading about in the newspaper, hearing on the air. So it's fresh, new, and ahead of the curve. Also today on our Environmental Watch, I'll be going over some of the things that we began discussing yesterday and add to it, and why we should be very concerned, and what we as individuals can do to help lessen global warming. And you thought it was all what the government was going to do. Forget what any government's going to do. The government's not going to do anything. Nothing in time and not enough. And only when they can make money from it will they do anything. But there's a lot we can do, more than what they could do, and we could do it right now today. Also, I'm going to play our clips from Julian Assange, a clip you have not heard. It ties right into what I'm going to be discussing with my guest in the second part of our program today. And that's about ISIS being funded by our allies, and in effect, the United States, and why the mainstream media won't discuss this. So then we're going to go over there and talk with my guest about this, and he will be a part of our continuing series on Conversations with Remarkable Minds, Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson. And we're going to talk about the deep state, how they're manipulating everything happening today, who are they, and from his personal experience running as chief of staff for the Secretary of State, Colin Powell, did he know the deep state was behind the war in Iraq? Did he become aware at the time or afterwards that everything Colin Powell said was just lies and propaganda, and it was this deep state behind that? That'll be an interesting discussion, because Colonel Wilkerson is one of the few people who are retired from the government, who had a long, distinguished career, but now is willing to tell the truth. So we'll get to that. So as you see, we have a lot to cover. Let's begin. From Iowa University, they're saying, and I mentioned this briefly yesterday, that if you want to lower your homocysteine, take folic acid. I'm going to expand on that because almost everyone I see, when they show me their blood chemistry, they have elevated homocysteine, elevated C-reactive protein. You can't feel it. Almost no one tests for it, and yet, if your homocysteine is elevated, let's say 15, 16, 17, you're at a real high degree of risk for a heart attack or stroke, and that's also true for C-reactive protein. Now, these are inflammatory markers produced by our liver. So they're suggesting in this study, and it was a study that was issued in Nutrition Research and Practice, peer review journal, that 400 micrograms of folic acid twice a day for 8 weeks was able to substantially change the outcome in this particular situation of blood pressure. That's good. And more people who have diabetes also have high blood pressure. They frequently go hand in hand. you're overweight, you're diabetic, and you have high blood pressure. Quote, here's what they say. In conclusion, folic acid supplementation might be beneficial for reducing homocysteine levels and decreasing lipid parameters in postmenopausal women of type 2 diabetes mellitus. Okay, that's only one piece that you need to know. Here are the other pieces. Equally important is folic acid, and I would not recommend 400 micrograms. I would recommend 1 methylated milligram. Then I would recommend 1 methylated milligram of B12 and 100 milligrams of B6 and 200 milligrams of trimethylglycine and 1,000 milligrams of vitamin C. So when you have B6, vitamin C, folic acid, B12, and trimethylglycine together, you really drop down your homocysteine, and it doesn't take 8 weeks. I've been able to help people in 1 week do it and take them out of harm's way. None of those supplements are expensive. None are toxic in the doses that you'd be using them, but it could save your life. Separately, when it comes to the issue of chocolate, I mentioned yesterday on the program that chocolate is good for the heart, and indeed it is. There are now several hundred studies on the benefits of the polyphenols that are in chocolate. Well, this is from Harvard University, and it talks about how the Aztec emperor Montezuma II said that a soldier could march for a whole day on a single cup of cacao, which is chocolate. By the way, that's not the hot chocolate that people would use today. It was gritty, it's bitter, and often had a kind of like a fatty scum on top. And if that doesn't sound unpleasant enough, it was occasionally laced with chili or even human blood. Modern sweet chocolate, with the added milk powder and sugar, is a product of the Industrial Revolution. But that's not what you want either. But over the past 30 years, researchers have started to shift our view of chocolate and cacao, the base ingredient in chocolate. And by the way, sometimes cacao is also called cacao, generally when it's, let's say, unprocessed or raw. And currently, there is no formally recognized difference between the two. So if someone's trying to promote that their chocolate is better because it's raw, there's no evidence at this point to support that. Arguably, the tide of opinion began to change about 1997 following the publication of a study by researchers at Harvard University on the Kuna people. And the researcher reported that the Kuna, K-U-N-A, who live on the islands off the coast of Panama, have very low blood pressure. They live long, long lives, longer than Americans, and have low rates of heart attack and stroke and type 2 diabetes and cancer, much better than even their own family members who live in Panama, where they're originally from. The thing that differentiates the island-dwelling Kuna from those who live on the mainland is their high consumption of cacao. On average, they drink about 5 cups of that per day. Now, since the publication of this study, many other laboratory and clinical studies seem to have confirmed the beneficial effects of chocolate and cacao. Mind you, what is the basic difference? Well, the basic difference is cacao, you're going to get it as a powder, and it's generally chunky and bitter. It's a bitter chocolate, and it's frequently used in making icings for cakes. But when you get chocolate, you're getting it, the cacao already processed. It has been put into a large blender, sugar, the fat of cream have been put in, possibly emulsifiers, stabilizers, enhancers, and preservatives. So it has chocolate, the chocolate has cacao, but generally a small quantity. Sometimes it could go, 10% actually cacao. What's hip today is you walk in and you just don't buy a bar of chocolate. You see the percentage of the cacao in there. That means that the total ingredients of what you're getting, let's say And the real, if you want the real therapeutic where it really has medicinal value, 70% and up. And I suggest 70 to 75% for most people because of palatability. You get up to 80, 85%, you're eating a bitter. And if you start sweetening that with stevia, you can end up with diarrhea. So only real hardcore believers in its medicinal value will go up above 80. But for everyone else, if you want to get the real benefits of helping your heart and your blood pressure, 70 and up. You can get tasty ones, and they'll try something. They'll put, raw chocolate with goji berries. And you'll suddenly pay $6, $7, $8, $9 a bar for like a 2-ounce bar, 3-ounce bar. In my opinion, it's not worth it. Because here's the gimmick. For all those little things like wolfberry or mangosteen that they put in, it's a tiny, tiny, tiny amount. So tiny, it wouldn't really help a cockroach. So it's just a gimmick. Better just to get it plain, just flavored. You know, you get like a vanilla flavor or a mint flavor. And then focus upon the fact that it's organic, vegan, kosher, non-GMO, fair trade. So the people who harvest it were properly paid for it, and sustainable. All those should be on a label. That's the one you should purchase. Now, additionally, if you can handle higher than 70%, good for you. If you can't, the difference between a lot of them is the amount of sugar they add. Make sure there is a sugar. The only sugar I would recommend would be raw coconut sugar, because it has low glycemic index and it's not a processed sugar. So that way you get the benefits. So what's in this? Well, they can lower your cholesterol, they can help your blood vessels, they can lower your blood pressure, that protects your heart, that's good for your arteries and good for your brain, can reduce your risk of stroke and diabetes. So we're not talking about something insignificant, we're talking about something very significant. You don't need much, 2 ounces a day. 2 ounces is a small amount. That's, you know, what are we talking about here? Under 60 grams. That's a tiny amount. Anyhow, what would fit in a teaspoon? That's what you need per day. So then you look inside that cacao. So why do those people off the coast of an island? Well, they actually live on a series of islands in right off Panama. But why do the Kuna people live such a long life? If the only thing that's different is the chocolate, it's because they're eating real high. They're not diluting it, so they're getting the full impact. So what's in there? Flavanols. Flava, F-L-A-V-A, nols, N-O-L-S. Particularly a compound called epicatechin. Epicatechin. E-P-I-C-A-T-C-H-I-N. Now, there are a lot of studies on epicatechin and how it's been shown to be one of the most powerful antioxidants found in nature. And it really is beneficial. So that's good. And you're also getting the ability for multiple pathways in our body, including helping blood vessels to relax more readily, which can lower blood pressure. But guess what else happens? When men in these islands eat this, they have greater capacity for erection, because one of the things we don't have is good blood vessels. A lot of men in the reproductive system, and that's why nitric oxide works, and that's what you would get from beet juice. That's why one of nature's most perfect promoters of full erectile function is 1 6-ounce glass of beet juice before you're anticipating having an erection, and then that will help you. That does the same thing as all those $700 or $70 a pill for one of those erectile dysfunction drugs that have very toxic side effects. So 6 ounces of beet juice can really help you. By the way, it also helps athletes. Before I compete, I always take 6 ounces of pure beet juice, and I add another 6 ounces of coconut water with it, and that's giving me the potassium and magnesium I want during my run, specifically a lot of potassium, more than you get in five or six bananas in that water. In any case, that is really good for you. It also drops down your bad LDL. So get your chocolate. Make sure it's healthy and good. And according to this Harvard study, it is really good for you. So that's our food of the day. Now, one of the reasons we have so many people having strokes and heart attacks in the United States is because we are so addicted to salty food. French fries, lots of salt. Then you go to the table and you put salt on it in addition to that. And then think of all the salt that's in a fast food meal. You could get up to 3,000 milligrams in one hamburger with toppings. Yeah, that's just one item in one meal. How much sodium do we need? Well, this is from Harvard University, published in the Journal of the American College of Cardiology, the current issue. And this is from the medical school in Boston. And what they found is this, that about 3.7 grams, that's a lot, of salt is associated with left ventricular longitudinal strain. And that means that you're going to have problems with your heart. That could put a strain on your heart. Now, that's not much when you compare to how much about 5,000 milligrams or 5 grams a day the average person consumes. So at 3.7, you're already hurting your heart. And in fact, these scientists performed what is called a speckle tracking analysis of 2,996 hypertensive genetic epidemiological network study echocardiograms, and they found that these people were consuming 3.7 grams a day. So that's not good. And this is separate and aside from smoking or alcohol use or all the other things we would do. That's just sodium. We don't need a lot of salt. We only need about 800 milligrams a day of sodium. 800 milligrams. And we're taking in 5 grams or 5,000 milligrams and more. Because people put salt on so many, and especially steaks and potatoes and potato chips, that's salty. So when you go above 3 grams, you're putting your heart directly at risk. And that's why so many young people in their teens are consuming so much bad food, so much salty food, and there's lots of sodium in a pizza also, that by the time they get in their 20s, they're already suffering from heart conditions. And if you really are addicted to salt and you want something to taste salty, it's not difficult. All you have to do is use lemon juice. Potatoes. And by the way, most people think you got to bake a potato up at baking at 400, 450 degrees. Not true. You can bake it at much lower temperatures. It just takes a longer. And it's not difficult. You just take a knife and you make a little slit on all four sides of the potato. Then you take some coconut oil and you massage it, just like you were giving a little massage to the potato, so it's all covered. Then put it in the middle of the oven, not up high or not down low where the flame's coming, and so it has more radiating heat, and then put it on a lower temperature. That way the potato gets baked where the moisture inside is drawn out through the slits, so it's baking from the inside out, not from just the outside in. That's why a lot of people bake potato at home, and then they open it up, and it's hard as rock inside, and yet it's overcooked on the outside. And then, so this way, you're getting the benefit of the alpha-lipoic acid, very important for your body's anti-aging, alpha-lipoic acid, because it's rich in the potato. But it's in the potato top skin and right underneath. So now you can have the baked potato that's healthy because the coconut oil has prevented it from being burned, because coconut oil, along with macadamia oil and mustard seed oil, are the three best oils to use in cooking because they protect that whatever you're cooking from high heat. They have high heat tolerance. Other oils have very low, including olive oils, very low heat tolerance. So anytime someone's cooking something at a high flame, using olive oil, they're scorching the oil. Now, here's the problem. When you overheat olive oil, it turns to a consistency similar to varnish, and that goes in our system, and it's very pro-inflammatory. Whereas if you took raw, cold-pressed virgin organic olive oil, it's anti-inflammatory. Heat is what changes the chemical bonds that makes it go from pro, turning off inflammation, to contributing to inflammation. So then when you have your potato and you open it up, then take lemon juice and squirt the lemons, let's say the juice of two lemons on that. And then you can use a little Himalayan sea salt and pepper and anything else you want, like I love raw onions on that. And you put lemon juice on raw onions and it tastes like salt, but it isn't. And it's healthy. Lemons always are healthy. That's just the latest. And finally, I'll do one more. And this is from Florida Atlantic University, published in PLOS Genetics, major peer-reviewed journal. Here's what it says, quote, restricting how much you eat without starving has been shown to robustly extend lifespan in more than 20 species of animals, including primates. How this works is still unclear. And they did a new study, and it showed that, quote, smelling food in addition to consuming calories could influence the aging process, and that's what's eating you. Or more specifically, your cells maybe provide clues to the healthy aging. So in lay language, it means this, that if we balance our intake of food so we're not always eating or something's always in our stomach being digested, so if you start your day with a really healthy smoothie, a handful of walnuts or almonds or cashews, and I'll throw in a pint of berries, blueberries, best, strongest of all the berries are blueberries, or pomegranate or raspberries are all good. And then have a teaspoon of coconut oil, teaspoon of flaxseed oil, and then a tablespoon of your best plant-based protein, whether it's hemp powder or split pea powder, which is very good, or brown rice powder, or non-genetically engineered soy powder. Get between, let's say, 15 to 25 grams protein. Then you've got everything you need. You've got quality fiber, you've got complex carbohydrate, you get essential fatty acids, and lots of antioxidants and phytonutrients. That's a perfect way to start your day. And it's going to digest relatively quickly, so it'll stabilize your blood sugar and give you the energy and restorative nutrients you need to repair from the breakdown and damage of your cells. Then have a light lunch and have even a lighter dinner. And if you feel hungry in between, have a healthy snack. An apple is a snack. A peach is a snack. Any of the fruits are a snack. Celery is a snack. But we just go into these concentrated caloric snacks like candies and chips. That's where you age. You're putting too many calories into the body. And instead, we should be putting less calories into the body. And that's what the science is showing. Hence, pulling back from all that extra food and calories, and alcohol gives you twice the calories as carbohydrates or protein, and fat gives you twice the calories of carbohydrate and protein. So make sure that you get back on all that fat and give up the alcohol. You'll lose weight, you'll live longer, and you'll feel better. That's the latest on health and healing. We're 23 minutes into our program. I'm Gary Noll. I'm on the road, broadcasting every day, keeping up on everything, finishing a lot of important work. We're going to take a brief break and come right back. I have a lot to share with you today. Please stay with us. Nice to have you with us, everyone. We're going to take a break right now. I want you to hear a brief clip about Professor Dawkins, a very widely known atheist who believes that everything that is based upon religion should be challenged. And for that, he has been attacked, and recently he was denied the opportunity to either be debated or have a discussion in California on KPFA, this Pacifica sister station out there. And this is an ongoing trend. Just last year, one of the most respected radio broadcasters in Pacifica, Bonnie Faulkner, who does a program that she originates herself and then provides it to Pacifica, called Guns and Butter. We carry it on the Progressive Radio Network. I have a lot of respect for Bonnie. She's a no-nonsense person. She does her homework, and yet she takes on controversial issues, but she shows the legitimacy in those issues. The mere fact that something is controversial does not mean and should not mean it should be denied a forum. Because just think of it this way. If you listened to a discussion I had with a former CIA analyst who went to prison for 3 years because he told the truth about what was happening with the CIA's rendition and torture. And you heard him say, prisoners died. That means murder. These were people who were bound, who were kept in torturous positions, and then they died. And he said they died. And he leaked that information to a journalist because he felt that no one was listening to him inside the agency. And he was inside the agency, and he had connections with Congress. Nobody would talk. And so at the end of our conversation, and this was yesterday, and I asked him a simple question. In more than 50 years of having a Senate and a House intelligent oversight committees made up of some very powerful people in Congress, including chairmen of those committees, they are supposed to be aware of everything our government's agencies that deal in secrecy are doing. And if they're doing something untoward, something illegal, something inappropriate, something that could damage the United States, its citizens, or other people without cause, they would be the first. They would be the canaries in the coal mine that would inform us. So I ask him a question. Can you name me one single person, one, that's it, one in the entire history of these committees outside of Frank Church? And he lost his election. They went after him real fast. And Wellstone ended up dying in a mysterious plane crash. But any member of those who can come forward and say, even though I vowed an oath of secrecy, I consider what I uncovered crimes against humanity perpetrated by people within our administration. I tried to see that this was dealt with inside the administration. I went up through the chain of command, and no matter where I went or how high I went, I was told, keep it to yourself, keep quiet, and go along. And I cannot do that any longer because this is wrong. There shouldn't be two sets of standards. So name me the one who broke that pact of not telling the truth. And the answer is not one. Even when the Senate's own intelligence committee members had their computers, personal computers, hacked and a spyware put in so that every single thing they were doing on their private their computers in Congress working for the government on the Intelligence Committee was being monitored so that the CIA knew what was going on in every single meeting and what anyone was deciding to do. That's a felony. I passed this through my own in-house counsel, and they said they should have been indicted. You can't do that. You can't spy. A government agency cannot spy upon members of Congress. And they had no reason to assume that every single member should be spied upon. But not a single person today has come forward. All that we could expect was a couple years ago, two people came forward saying, what we saw really terrifies us. What'd you see? Well, we can't tell you. We're bound by secrecy. And then I remember when I was investigating the FDA, I had gotten a tip from someone inside the FDA, this goes back over 25 years ago, that everyone at the highest level in the FDA knew that the tobacco industries, all of the major tobacco industries, held patents on cigarettes where it was shown that these cigarettes were proven to be addictive and cause cancer. So I went back and did a statistical analysis of how many people have died from smoking-related illnesses in the last 100 years. The most conservative figure I could come up with was 20 million. Now, every time the members of the tobacco industry, including a very famous scene where seven members of the largest tobacco companies came forward, raised their hand under oath, said, are you aware of anything that's addictive or caught? No, nothing at all. There's no science. And we knew that that was a lie. Our government knew that that was a lie. The FDA knew that was a lie. But no one wanted to betray the proprietary rights. So a patent was more valuable than the lives of 20 million Americans. So that taught us a lot about our FDA and whose allegiance they would abide by. Now, who told us that they were lying? A whistleblower. And that whistleblower later would become with Crowe, the actor, Russell Crowe, the insider, and that was based upon Mike Wallace working with that insider to exploit this, and how the industry was so powerful, it interfered in that process coming to light with the top people at the network because of all the advertising dollars they were fearful of losing. The same is true with vaccines. We have two major lawsuits going on now. They've been going on for a year. You haven't heard a word about these lawsuits. Why? Because the company Merck is so powerful, and these are real insiders, that the two scientists who want to report upon falsification of data, safety data, and efficacy data in these vaccine trials, yet you don't hear a word about it. So the government is not allowing the people working inside to tell the truth. It comes from outside. Rachel Carson told us about DDT. The government denied it. We found out about Agent Orange, not from Monsanto, and not from the government, not from the EPA. We found out about PCBs, and we found out about dioxin, heptachlor. We found out about 2,4-5-T. All these different chemicals we found out never once by the government. And I remember interviewing people from the EPA saying that it was like a battle room in there where those who wanted to tell the truth were told you can't tell the truth and you've signed agreements. And so they quit and came on the show. So here we have it. So we have a situation where members of Congress know the truth and are refusing to tell us. And what does that tell you about their loyalty or the legitimacy of their intelligence oversight committees when they're not sharing with us what they have been exposed to or know or have reason to consider? My guest is on the line now. I was just told, so we're going to introduce again Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson. He is standing by, and I want to welcome him once again to our program. For those of you who don't know him, he is a retired U.S. Army colonel and a former chief of staff in General Colin Powell's office while he was Secretary of State. He currently is a distinguished adjunct professor of government and public policy at the College of William & Mary in Virginia. And Colonel Wilkerson started as an assistant to General Powell in 1989 and remained with him through his term in the Bush administration. He's been an outspoken critic of the Iraq War and the Bush and Cheney White House, including his own preparation for what became a famous Powell's 2003 presentation regarding Iraq's possession of weapons of mass destruction at the UN, which was the final push that America needed to legitimize its going into Iraq. And he is the author of, or I should say, it was important in several of the documentaries, including Why We Fight, a separate one, The Israeli Lobby, and a separate one, No One in Sight. In 2009, he received the Sam Adams Award for Integrity and Intelligence. Nice to have you with us today.
Good to be with you.
Before we start, I have a very short clip. It's only about a minute and a half long. This is a clip between Julian Assange and an interviewer, John Pilger, who I have an enormous amount of respect for, one of the best journalists in the world. I believe he's around 75 now and still going strong. And this is where he is stating unequivocally and directly that Hillary Clinton knew and communicated her full knowledge that ISIS and other terrorist groups were being funded by the people she was doing business with, the Secretary of State, that she was getting the largest arms deal in history, one that was so large, almost $100 billion, that they had a special celebration party at the holidays in the State Department for this big deal, and also was receiving over $100 million to the Clinton Foundation. All this at the same time she is saying we need a war on terrorism, and yet she's telling John Podesta in an email that has never been challenged for accuracy, and yet not once has the media challenged her on, if you knew that these people were funding terrorists in Saudi Arabia and in Qatar, why didn't you do anything? Why didn't you say anything? Listen to this, please, from Julian Assange.
There's a early 2014 email from Hillary Clinton, so not so long after she left Secretary of State, to her campaign manager, John Podesta. That email, it states that ISIS, is funded by Saudi Arabia and Qatar. The governments of Saudi Arabia and Qatar. Now, I think this is the most significant email in the whole collection. And perhaps because Saudi and Qatari money is spread all over the place, including into many media institutions. All serious analysts know, even the US government has mentioned or agreed with, that some Saudi figures have been supporting ISIS, funding ISIS. But the dodge has always been it's just some rogue princes using their cut of the oil money to do whatever they like, but actually the government disapproves. But that email says that no, it is the governments of Saudi and the government and Qatar that have been funding ISIS.
The Saudis, the Qataris, the Moroccans, the Bahrainis, particularly the Saudis and the Qataris, are giving all this money to the Clinton Foundation while Hillary Clinton is Secretary of State and the State Department is approving massive arms sales, particularly to Saudi Arabia.
Yeah. Under Hillary Clinton, and our Clinton emails reveal a significant discussion about it, the largest ever arms deal in the world was made with Saudi Arabia, more than $80 billion. In fact, during her tenure as Secretary of State, total arms exports from the United States in terms of the dollar value doubled.
Doubled. And of course, the consequence of that is that this notorious terrorist jihadist group called ISIL or ISIS is created largely with money from the very people who are giving money to the Clinton Foundation.
Yes.
There you have it. So I wanted people to hear this because you heard him say two things that were relevant to me, and I'm going to ask you to address this in just a second. That of all those 30-some thousand emails, the most important was what he just said, that Hillary knew all along, which means Barack Obama knew, which means that she was communicating also with the head of our National Security Agency, the CIA, the Defense Department. They were all fully aware that the main supporters of terrorism in the Middle East were our allies. And therefore, we were making money from arms shipments, and that meant all those hundreds of thousands of jobs and contractors in Washington were being supported by this myth that if we want to fight terrorism in the Middle East, we have to get allies that we can work with, and these are the allies we can work with, and those are the very people who are funding these. And yet no one in the media has picked up on this. Would you address this, please?
Well, the first thing I would say is that I think historians, at least, and people like me who teach this subject matter, have known that the presidents of the United States in the post-World War II era, since Nixon at least, but certainly beginning strongly with Reagan's first term, have known about the perfidy of the Saudis. They have traded oil and money an exchange of arms for ignoring that perfidy. That's a simple policy decision that every president of the United States has made with increasing bad results in the last decade or so, but at least since Nixon. It's all about oil. It's all about money. It's all about our having to pay vast sums of money for their oil, and they're having to pay in exchange vast sums of money for our weapons. It's a bargain with the devil, but it's a bargain that we have lived with for quite some time. It has become more obvious that it's a bad bargain in the last couple of decades, particularly since 9/11, because the Saudis are the biggest exporters of terrorism on the face of the earth. Let me say that again. The Saudis are the biggest exporters of terrorism on the face of the earth.
I appreciate you sharing that concern with us. What, as a person who's worked within the institutions, including the State Department, what would have been the most reasonable and honest and authentic way of approaching that information if we really cared about ending terrorism and working with people or who were really opposed to terrorism, not funding it, and stop working with people who support terrorism?
We've had a policy route that's lain before us now at least for two decades that would have done just that. And I would have great difficulty, it would take a long time because it's a complicated story, in telling you why we haven't taken that policy route. Essentially, it involves two or three things. One, it involves the fact that we've already gotten rid of the need for Saudi oil. We do not need a drop of their oil. And people will argue that the Japanese still do, the Koreans still do, other of our allies, but I would say back to them, I'm sorry, oil is a fungible thing. As long as it's on the market, it's going to make its way to the person, or the state that needs it. So that's not an excuse anymore. We are independent of Middle East oil now. We do not need it, nor do our allies really need us defending it the way we have in the past. So that's the first aspect of this new policy approach, that we don't need the oil anymore. The second aspect is we don't need to sell the arms anymore. We're the greatest arms merchant in the world by a factor of almost two times. We're the greatest merchant of death in the world. It does irreparable harm to our reputation in the world, which is a real aspect of our power in the world, so we should stop that too. But we've got the military-industrial complex, which Eisenhower warned us about, built up to the extent where that's very difficult to do. You can't tell Lockheed and Raytheon and Boeing not to sell these arms to foreign countries anymore. And then the third thing you've got going for you is the fact that we do have an alternative power that, oddly enough, we accuse all the time of sponsoring terrorism, which is probably the least sponsor of terrorism in the sense that terrorism is meant, in the Middle East, and that's Iran, with whom we now have a nuclear agreement to halt their nuclear program, and could have used that agreement as a policy avenue and a real avenue in order to create better relations with Iran. But, of course, that would have been at the expense of the Saudis. So if we had put these three policy realities together and crafted a new overall policy towards Southwest Asia, towards the Middle East, we could be rid of Saudi Arabia, and I dare say that if we were rid of her, she'd disappear in a week or two, and we could have a different relationship with the real country in the Middle East that makes a difference, Iran. 75 million people who are very homogeneous, 5,000-year history, and are not really a sponsor of terrorism except in the sense that Hezbollah stands opposite to Israel. And they need something to stand opposite to a state that possesses nuclear weapons. Incidentally, the only state in that particular area that does. And so it's understandable why Iran looks to Hezbollah as an arm that it can use to sort of offset Israel's nuclear superiority. If we were to pursue this new policy, we'd have a whole different game in the Middle East today. And I submit to you it would be far more stable. It would be far more looking better in terms of prosperity for its people, in terms of eventual freedom for its people, democracy and so forth. But no, we don't have the courage and we don't have the political will to stand up to these other forces, these more or less recidivist forces, these forces from the past, and tell them to go away, defeat them, and create a new policy. We simply can't do it.
There is something I believe you could do, you personally could do, because you're highly respected and you have that deep knowledge because you're a scholar in the field. I believe that we need someone to go forth on the internet and do a very good presentation of what really happened. And now we have absolute proof. It's not conspiratorial. Just this week, the 1953 Iran coup documents have become public. And the State Department gave these documents, and it shows that the United States was in fact being under the Truman administration, was being asked by the British Foreign Office to involve themselves in late 1952 in a coup to overthrow Iranian Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh, who was a peace activist, by the way. He was a scholar. He was not a violent person. And according to freshly declassified State Department documents posted just yesterday, for the first time, two previous top secret memorandum from senior officials at the State Department refer to a series of communications and meetings between the October 1952 in which British officials tried to win U.S. approval of Mossadegh's ouster. And today's posting consists of the most explicit officially declassified records that show in these two documents how that they agreed, but they were going to do it in stages, and they involved the CIA and the National Security Council documents and the a part of the Foreign Relations of the United States series, and it showed how they went about it. Why? It was all for the oil. Mossadegh wanted to give a fair market value to the British and then take back the possession of the oil wells, and they didn't want, British Petroleum didn't want their oil well taken back, so they got involved. But the kick for the United States was two American companies could come in and then exploit the oil also. So it wouldn't just be one company. There would be the United States interest. So on the wrong pretext, they did this coup for the wrong reasons. They ousted him and were initially going to kill him, but allowed him to be under house arrest and temporarily. And then they brought in the Shah of Iran. Now, to tell the story of who was the Shah, because the average American thinks the Shah was this great person, and his Savat secret police, which arrested all of the democracy advocates in Iran, the religious leaders, everyone who could do anything that would motivate the power of the people, were arrested, tortured, and over 50,000 killed. And the United States oversaw that because he didn't have the experience. So they brought in CIA agents to show them how you got this done. And for the next 26 years, the Shah of Iran was the best friend of the United States and the oil companies and until the overthrow. And then why was there an overthrow? And if you showed the history that Iran has not invaded another country in 241 years and showed that they are abiding by the International Atomic Energy Commission guidelines, and that there's cameras on every single door, every lock is checked, their inspections constantly, their centrifuges have been controlled, that they're not a threat, and that the neocons have tried to make a Netanyahu, and particularly try to make him a threat to cause another war there. And then Hillary Clinton, if she was elected, she already promised publicly that she would support Israel in whatever it had to do against there. And then suddenly Israel ends up with a malware on their Iranian computers that would have turned off all the electricity in the country, that had no way of defending themselves. And in my opinion, though there's this is my own speculation, the only reason that Israel would have wanted all electricity off is because there had been no way to know that an incoming flight should take out the facilities. The United States would spin it in a positive way. One of the demons of the world are done. One of the modern Hitlers are done. The acts of evil are done. Now we just got two more. We got Russia and China. Well, oh, yeah, and North Korea. She didn't get elected. So that didn't happen yet. And so I'm concerned that the truth about Iran's history has not been given. And someone like yourself, I believe, would do the world an enormous justice, especially if you got that up there well presented to the young millennials who are going to be the backbone of the next election cycle, to educate them this is not the country we should be demonizing. As you said, we should be working together. Your thoughts, please.
Well, I agree with you that we should be working together in the modern context. Just to amend your history there just a little bit, I've studied this issue quite comprehensively. Harry Truman actually refused the British overtures. He stalled. It wasn't until Eisenhower became president, and Eisenhower's initial inclination was to stall and even to refuse, too, until Alan Dulles, director of the CIA, got to him, and the British got to him, and Eisenhower finally agreed to overthrow Mossadegh. So if we're going to blame a president, let's blame Eisenhower. But basically what you described is the case over the 26 years. The Shah was our man in the Gulf. What I've argued is that if Iran was recognized under a dictator, a very heinous and cruel dictator, as you pointed out, as the regional hegemon, as the country to be reckoned with, as the country that had the most potential for keeping things stable and keeping things peaceful in the region, why now that they are basically democratic in the way they run their elections and so forth? They may have a theocratic element to it, but they're basically they're the most democratic country in the Gulf, as a matter of fact, in the way they run their elections and so forth. Why now, if none of those realities have changed, why now make them an enemy? Doesn't make any sense. And the other things you've pointed out about the Iranians not being aggressive and so forth are true. Why not make them a friend? And the reason is very simple. It's a one-word answer to that reason: Israel.
Could you tell us about Israel, especially in light of the fact that Americans are not aware that Benjamin Netanyahu, the current prime minister, is in some very precarious water because his chief of staff has agreed just recently to testify for the prosecution against him, and he is vehemently opposed to Iran, but has been supporting, according to the latest interviews that I have seen, and these are, I consider, credible, people who were there and present when Israel was taking wounded ISIS or al-Nusra or al-Qaeda into their country, helping them get back and then sending back in the zone. And if we knew that Israel, the people we give in $3 billion a year to, were supporting terrorists against Syria, it would give us a different impression. They couldn't have done that without Netanyahu.
Well, one man's freedom fighter is another man's terrorist, and vice versa. That's just as true now as it ever has been. The right-wing government in Israel is not supported, I find, and polls find, too, by 65 to 70% of Jews in America. That is, American Jews. The community in America is majority non-supportive of Netanyahu's right-wing government. If you look at more sophisticated polls in Israel itself, not counting the Arab citizens, but just the Jewish citizens, you find a similar phenomenon, though not quite as pronounced. That is to say, they don't like the Netanyahu right-wing government. What you're seeing now, I think, is a small part of that dislike being manifested in what happened to Eric Sharon, for example, at the end of his Likud government before he died, and that is that he's so corrupt that the courts are after him. The Israeli courts are going to get him, I think, because his family and he himself are so corrupt. They've been accepting all kinds of money and support and so forth that they shouldn't have been, according to Israeli law. But this extremely right-wing government in Israel is composed of parties who are very supportive of the settlers in the West Bank, where a condition of apartheid exists. Jimmy Carter was right when he described it as apartheid. They're very supportive of Netanyahu's idea of a greater Israel. I think he even covets Jordan. You may have noticed that recently the king of Jordan visited Ramallah and talked to the Palestinian leadership. That was a clear signal from the king in Jordan that Israel better stop what it's doing and not incite another intifada, another war that they could then react to with major modern weaponry and kill men, women, and children and everything else, as they've done recently in Gaza. So the king of Jordan is sending a very strong signal to Netanyahu. Netanyahu needs to go, and his government needs to collapse. The Israelis need an entirely new government, and they need an entirely new policy towards the two-state solution, towards peace in the Middle East, and so forth. Otherwise, Israel's security, unlike what some of these right-wing people think, is in deep jeopardy.
I appreciate that answer. Thank you. You're not going to hear that from anyone in the mainstream media.
No, no, you're not. They don't even want to talk about it. They just ignore it.
The final question for today I have for you, and I realize we're a little abbreviated in time, but it deals with the deep state. I think that for many disillusioned Americans, the U.S. no longer has a real national purpose except for remaining on top of the world, our sense of exceptionalism. And we've now seen Trump's campaign promises being bogus fluff to win votes. And this certainly seems to be the case since almost 90% of our bills and acts support invested interests and not the larger American population and the average citizen. Moreover, we have over 900 military bases scattered throughout the world, and the U.S. certainly qualifies to be called an empire. And to sustain an empire, and a predominantly militarized one at that, requires an extensive infrastructure that operates outside of the public view, and it needs to act independently and without being exposed to public scrutiny. It has its own agenda, which may or may not be in harmony with the desires of the American majority or even democratic. And for a long time, going back to Eisenhower, that you just mentioned his name, and his famous warning of the military-industrial complex, and even before that, there has been references to the existence of a shadow government or a deep state. But this has usually been the subject of conspiracy theory. However, now, even mainstream media has at least opened itself up to saying, yes, there is a deep state, though no one wants to define it. So I'd like, if you would, please, to define that.
You know, I think there is a certain veracity to the idea of the middle bureaucracy being a, quote, deep state, unquote. But I don't think it's nearly as negative a development as others have stated it is. Here's what I think is the negative development, and you started your show with it, or at least the portion I was privy to. It's the people like Bill and Hillary Clinton at the top of the heap, so to speak, who can exploit the idiosyncrasies, the bureaucracies of the deep state, in order to make themselves filthy rich. That's what it's all about. Look at the Clinton Foundation. Look at how Hillary Clinton went to places as Secretary of State and strong-armed people into donating some people who weren't necessarily very savory characters, who ran very savory states like Kazakhstan, for example, and bent their elbows as Secretary of State of the United States and got them to contribute to the Clinton Foundation. And all these protestations from Bill and Hillary about, look at all the good we're doing, are just risible, in my view, because what they're doing is collecting enormous wealth for themselves and their cronies. There's your real deep state.
I certainly appreciate that insight. That is something that is new and fresh, and we have to consider that also. Colonel Wilkerson, we're out of time. I always appreciate you coming on because you're always an insightful person to us. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me. Take care.
Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson is my guest. I'm going to let everyone know that we will have him back when some new information is coming upon us. We're out of time. Appreciate you all taking your time to listen. Look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day. We'll be right back.